Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the New Statesman podcast. This week, Deputy Editor Helen Lewis speaks to singer and artist Amanda Palmer and novelist Neil Gaiman about their guest-edited issue for the New Statesman.
In this week's New Statesman, we have not one but two guest editors to talk a little bit about the behind-the-scenes aspect. Neil, I'm going to ask you first. Was it you or Amanda who came up with the idea of the theme, saying the unsayable?
I think that theme was mine. Amanda and I were sitting around. We'd been asked if we'd like to guest edit, and we started making lists of possible subjects, and saying the unsayable, I think, was mine.
But there was no doubt when we took on the job, we sort of both looked at each other and nodded our heads going like, of course, what it's probably, you know, what the issues are going to be is what we've been talking about with all of our friends in every bar and around every dinner table, which is the age of outrage and the kind of weird new levels of censorship and anger and internet kerfuffle that seem to be happening to us and everybody we know. But it's a really sticky, slippery, messy topic, and what a great place to collect everybody's thoughts about it.
That's something that comes up several times in the issue, isn't it? The idea that although restrictions on speech have never been fewer, you know, we all live in countries that don't have blasphemy laws, finally, you know, that America's got the First Amendment. At the same time, people often don't feel free to say what they want to for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, the censorship is, you know, it's internal. Mm. And the internet has been, I mean, I'm fascinated by the internet and social media, and having been inside it and standing outside and looking at it, it's really, it's bizarre how we start policing ourselves when we just don't want to deal with the drama of, you know, what, tweeting the wrong thing or offending someone out there. I mean, the thing about the internet is that it doesn't matter what you say, it will reach someone that it can offend, and because it's a universal platform. And, you know, if we all dumb it down to the point where anything we say will offend no one, we'll all just be rendered completely mute.
And Neil, do you think this is a temporary? Is this a temporary madness? This age of outrage? Is everyone just going to get bored of being angry all the time?
I think that, in the same way that this age of outrage was unpredictable, when it's going to stop and how it's going to stop is also unpredictable. It's kind of like one of the things like privacy, where in 40 years' time, it might be absolutely unthinkable to people when they are being told that actually the idea that the presidential elections of previous years would have been troubled by the fact that there were photographs of the president displaying her naked body on the web.
There's a candidate who I met who's now just become an MP. She's our youngest MP for 200 years. Her name's Mary Black. She's Scottish National Party. And she had a Twitter account that she'd had since she was 14. And she had written the kind of things that 14-year-olds write on their Twitter accounts. But she was, to me, the first of that generation whose, you know, their life was their unguarded thoughts that they had never had any idea that they would become a public figure were out there.
Yep.
And I always thought there'd be a watershed moment when you get the first person who's, you know, who's foolishly sent somebody who they couldn't trust a naked photo, ran for office. But at some point you think, will everyone get over it?
But I think there's going to be a point at which everybody who is running for office will have had naked photographs of themselves floating around, because one of the things that people do with cameras is take photos of themselves not wearing very much. And cameras are phones, and everybody has one. So it's one of those things where you're going, okay, strange definitions of privacy, the way that we think about privacy. And they aren't going to change, and the way that we treat speech is going to change, and it may change in what we say to whom. It may also change because I think what is acceptable is starting to change. And
rapidly, too. I mean, it's amazing to me how fast, you know, what's acceptable in language is changing. I mean, as someone who's got Amanda fucking Palmer as her stage name, I've watched just in the course of my career the word fuck go from being something absolutely unutterable to, like, the Fuck Cancer campaign, and also, you know, and it's almost like, well, not
Apple,
even generational.
So,
it's like this has happened in the past 5 or 10 years.
But I wanted to ask you, Amanda, because I think what's really interesting about you, particularly as an artist and as somebody, you know, when female bodies are so kind of picked over and dissected in popular culture, you've leaned into that, I guess, is probably the way to put it in internet speak. Are there things that you are very private about, though? Are your thoughts kind of more private than you feel? You feel more kind of, you want to keep a grip on them than your body or how that images of you are used?
I think it's really interesting to see how and what my idea of privacy plays out. And I've learned this. I mean, it's kind of been like a learned skill, having had a relationship with fans and the internet and the press, which is I can use myself as much as I want. I can't use other people. And that was something that I learned in the early days of my blog, which was, you know, I can reach way, way down into the bottom of my soul and discuss and and dissect my deepest insecurities, my darkest thoughts and stuff like that. But I can't share anybody else's story. And that's stuff that I learned early on the internet, where it was, you know, I was with my bandmate, and I remember, you know, Brian and I were touring together, and, like, you know, Brian had like a breakdown on tour, and there I was, like, blogging about it, going like, and Brian's freaking out, and Brian was like, yeah, that's not your story to tell. You can't share my life on your blog. And I think you can always come at it from, and I always come at it just from the idea of, what's my intention, and am I harming anyone? I can harm myself. I can bring kerfuffles and controversy galore upon myself, but it's really not my right to ever drag anybody else into it.
We both tweet, Amanda and I, and we both have social presence. And once and only once in the 7 years of our relationship did we let a squabble start to happen online, and it upset us both to the point where we went, and it was tiny. She was in play rehearsals. She only had a very short dinner break or lunch break. I was trying to see her, but I was stuck in a meeting, and she tweeted about it.
I was waiting. I was the jilted date, waiting in a cafe with like a 37-minute break, and Neil had promised he would run over. But then he was 5 minutes late, and I was like, should I order? I need to eat. And then he was 10 minutes late. And by the time he was like 20 minutes late and my break was half over, I sent a passive-aggressive tweet. I don't even remember what it was. Do you remember what
it was? I don't
know
what it was. I mean, the point was that suddenly...
You know, dick husband is late or something.
And it was... I wasn't even husband at that point. I think I was still boyfriend or possibly fiancé. But the point was suddenly... something that should have been private felt like it was going to, at that point, probably 500,000 people. And we realized that if that was a really bad thing to have done, because it just moved everything into a different place. And we figured out, thank heavens, on a tiny, insubstantial thing, that we don't do that.
Mm.
And
If it makes you feel better, my boyfriend and I had an argument about Periscope once. We did a live stream of Periscope about the TV leaders debates, and then we had an argument about the fact that I felt he was being insufficiently contributing to the Periscope. And I thought at that point, this is an argument that no one in history has ever had before about like our live stream thoughts about what Nicola Sturgeon is saying. I just want to talk finally about the issue. What was the piece that came in that most surprised you, that you weren't kind of quite expecting?
I loved Andrew O'Neill's piece on being a comedian and being and needing to be offensive in order for what you do to happen. And I felt like if there was one piece in there that I would want, you know, I would want it on school syllabuses. While I loved Rowan Williams on blasphemy and why blasphemy can be important, why I loved Michael Sheen, why I loved Lenny's piece, I think Andrew O'Neill explaining why comedy sometimes needs to be offensive, I want every 14-year-old to know that, with swearing included.
And also the bit about the idea that you have to be able to deal with being offended. You have to, you know, because he talks very, it's a fascinating piece. He talks about kind of going to perform to kind of hen nights and stag nights and just being incredibly rude to them. And then, you know, for them, comedy is a night out. And you call me a twat. Yeah, very funny, mate. And then you throw a bottle at him and it's all fine. Whereas if you go and perform at an art centre, everyone thinks that comedy is this, like, let's have an exploration of the human soul. And if you say, you know, a wrong word, then that's kind of, you know, then you've let your fans down. Do you think that maybe we asked too much of comedians? I don't know. I wonder if they're the kind of canary in the mine for offensiveness.
I don't think we should ask anything of comedians, and I don't think we should ask anything of artists and musicians. I think that's looking at it backwards. The job of a comedian and an artist and a musician is to make the art and put out the statement and make the commentary and have the deep feeling and express the thought. And I think one of the things that you do, and it's been really interesting in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, is like, you know, the public does not dictate what art the artists make. You react, you can argue, you can confirm or deny that you agree with it or that you would have or would have not made that. But the minute you've got a public going like, well, actually, this is not the kind of art we make, the public's job is to receive the art and react, but not to set the agenda. I think once the public starts setting the artistic agenda, we're in trouble.
I thought that was interesting because, Neil, you picked that up in your diary because you went to the Penn Gala about Charlie Hebdo and about people's kind of inability to separate the idea of, I wouldn't do that, I wouldn't publish what Charlie Hebdo publishes, but I support their right to do it. And that's actually something that I think people who would otherwise describe themselves as progressive and liberal maybe even have about tabloid newspapers. You know, you sort of say, well, I don't like what's in The Sun or The Mail or The Telegraph or The Express, but I support their right to publish it. That's quite a hard thing for liberals to do, isn't it?
I think it is. And I think it's the quicksand.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
That many people who think of themselves as liberal and progressive step into and find themselves stuck in and sinking slowly into deeper and deeper. When I wrote my diary piece, which was about why, you know, hosting a table at the Penn Gala from which six other writers had pulled out because they didn't want to be associated, they didn't want to be present when Charlie Hebdo was applauded, they said. For me, it was very simple. I, as somebody who had done comics for years, had watched my stuff being banned, had fought to keep it on the shelves, had worked with the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is in America the big First Amendment organization, and many times had to go, I think this is disgusting, I think this is appalling. It is absolutely legal for it to have been published, and I am now going to deploy money, I'm going to deploy legal resources, and I'm going to fight for the right of this to exist, and I'm going to fight for the right of this to exist because the moment that I say everything is, you know, free speech is great, except for this stuff, which I think is rather dodgy. Those people, the ones who I think are rather dodgy, are allowed to turn around and say, well, everything is fine except for Neil's speech, which I think is rather dodgy. And that, for me, is the part of the liberal agenda which just gets lost, because they are so... I'll even throw in a we there, because we are so convinced of the rightness of our position, and it seems so self-evidently logical that how could anybody disagree with us, because we are right-thinking people who are saying right things. So obviously, freedom of speech issues will never apply to us.
But that circles back to the point you were making about kind of Twitter and social media expanding our horizons so much. Is the weird parallel thing that's happened at exactly the same time is people have gone into this, Ayla Parasa calls it the filter bubble, you know, that you talk only to people. Like, so on Twitter, I mostly follow people who have the same political opinions as me, the same opinions like what is racist or sexist or homophobic. And therefore, I'm kind of almost always slightly shocked to come into collision with reality.
Well, and the technology is actually making everything worse, because there are just these huge studies published that were shocking about the Google filter bubble. Mm. And, you know, and we don't even realize, most people have no awareness of the fact that Google is tailoring their searches to, you know, there's a, I forget, there was a great TED Talk about filter bubbles, which showed... you know, two different men.
If you've got like Republican friends,
right,
and you've been searching,
you know,
for kind of NRA
two
stuff.
Two people searching for Egypt, yeah. On one particular week. One got an entire page of political headlines, and one got travel to Egypt. And it really is, it's terrifying, because we think, you know, we think of Google as a friend, and we think of the internet as, you know, as open and
transparent as well.
And transparent, and the information is all just there for everyone to share. But I don't think we realize that we are slowly being pushed into places that, you know, unwittingly we're winding up not even seeing the information.
I think it's also interesting because it is easy to do a certain amount of self-selection with your newspapers and your magazines.
And your Twitter feed.
You can read the Guardian and the New Statesman, or you could read the Telegraph and the Spectator, and you are going to get two different worldviews, and you're going to assume that all right-minded people agree with your worldview. But it is weirder when the digital villages that we live in become a sort of long tail of people who agree with us. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you start to assume that everybody thinks like you do. I watch Tumblr is very strange for that, because you'll watch people getting together on Tumblr and agreeing with each other and retweeting and agreeing, and you're going, this is
kind of crazy.
This is, well, if not, I wouldn't have said that, but they're wrong.
Layers and layers of irony here.
But also that you can see, because I find Tumblr is interesting because it's much more youth-oriented than me, that it makes me feel at 31 like a kind of elderly, you know, guy right. yelling at a cloud. And you kind of think they've invented a whole, almost a completely different language even to talk about.
But it's a lot, issues. And it's a lot of mob mentality. And the things that sort of, you know, like tumble, snowball into giant memes are... you can really see playing out there, and especially because it's a younger set and a teenage set where everyone has that desperate need to, like, be in a group and belong and feel like they're caught up in, you know, one giant mass snowball. You really see it playing out in real time there because of the way things collect and balloon, which you don't see so much on Twitter because things can't expand infinitely like that.
I remember the point where I started to understand it and wasn't entirely comfortable with what I was seeing was a point where somebody had simply asked me a question about, I think it was Anna Sarkeesian and Lacey Green both being forced off the internet around the same time, and I did a little reply saying about hate, and saying why hate was a bad thing, and, you know, directing hate at people online was never going to be a good thing. And I got replies from the people who would grow up to be the Gamergate Brigade, explaining that their hate for Anna Sarkeesian and her like was a virtuous, powerful, and important thing, and that I should not underestimate their hate. And their hate was good and clean and powerful. And letters from the people who were hating on Lacey Green, explaining why their social justice warrior hate for her was absolutely justified and powerful. And they were the same letters. It was just, I wanted to send them to each other and go,
cut out the middleman.
You are the same people.
Yeah.
But you don't know it.
You're just the hatey people if you think on different sides of the hate fence.
You think you're on different sides.
Right.
And you are on exactly the same side. You're on the side of hate, and that's not good.
I had that same experience in the middle of one of these, I can't remember what, Twitter storm. I went to France, and I went around, because I'm a nerd, a lot of 16th century French castles. And there was a lot of stuff about the wars of religion. And then I suddenly had this kind of vision of, oh, hang on a minute, this is the same thing that is people, not only it's hate, but it's self-righteous hate. It's I have to hate you because this is a cleansing hate and a purifying hate. And that was it was that mixture of the kind of the intoxicatingness of how good people felt about having somebody to hate that I recognised, and then I thought we're all doomed.
I have one question for you.
Yes.
Why did you pick us?
I picked you because if anyone, Jemima picked you, because I thought, we thought that you would bring something. What we try and do with our guest editors is somebody who is close enough to what our core mission is, you know, talking about politics and culture and society, but brings a completely different perspective that we wouldn't be able to bring in ourselves. But you have to pick somebody who's kind of in the Venn diagram. There's a bit of overlap, but not too much overlap, because otherwise it's too much like a normal issue. So what I wanted from both of you was that the idea of particularly what it means to be an artist now. I thought that was a really interesting question, and it's something that several people in the issue have talked about. In an age when, you know, you have a much closer relationship with your fans, when both of you have a social media presence, both of you actually manage to produce art instead of procrastinating all the time, which is kind of something that everybody who is creative moans about constantly. Like, the world is now too interesting and it's hard to produce art. But also that you seem to have an interestingly eclectic range of friends and people around you, which is really important. Like, there was a Catholicism to your thinking, which is what the New Statesman, I think, tries to do, is not just talk about issues in a very narrow perspective, but jam things together. And like as I was saying earlier, I think this is the only magazine ever produced that has a porn star and a former Archbishop of Canterbury in it.
I'm very proud of us for getting Rowan Williams and Stoyer into bed.
Yeah.
Metaphorically, in the New Statesman.
And those are the kind of things that guess that it's really fly when you have joyful collisions and unexpectedness. And so the example, the other thing that I really love is Khaled Hosseini's very moving piece about going to refugee camps in Syria, juxtaposed with JR's artwork from Ellis Island, and saying, you know, 100 years ago, these were the economic migrants. Mm-hmm. These were people who just left everything that they had and made a new life, and the world keeps turning.
And what
that was hugely important for me, because it took it. I mean, speaking as somebody who's been to the Jordanian Syrian refugee camps and was moved and broken by it, what I loved about illustrating with JR's Ellis Island art is it makes you realize this is universal. We're not, when we're talking about refugees, we're not just talking about these people in this place. We're talking about what happens to humanity and what we as humans owe each other.
Yeah.
And the beauty of that, I was saying earlier, one of the great things about this issue is that it's not like we just showed up with a list of 20 people and then you guys did the work and we got those 20 writers. And it was an organically growing, changing, evolving discussion as pieces came in, and we saw holes and we saw connections. JR's art never would have gotten in if I hadn't been in a particular neighborhood in Soho, going on a long walk with Art Spiegelman, talking about the cover, and picking up art at JR's studio, at which point JR said, "Have you seen my new book? Look at these refugee images." And I went, "Oh my God, can we use these in the issue? These are beautiful." And there were beautiful coincidences and sparks sort of like lit all over the issue, because honestly, if we had just gotten we had our fantasy wish lists at the beginning, but if all those people had just just said yes, sure, and then we had showed up 3 months later and those pieces had been written, I don't think it would have been as good. You know, it felt like a great gardening work in process where we sort of made room for things and things dropped out.
We definitely planted things, and some you know, some great interviews and articles didn't happen. Mm. But then the things that happened instead were actually, I think, in many cases gave us more sort of, you know, magazine-y synergy than we might have got from some of the others.
I think that's the difference between, I mean, I love internet and publishing online, but the point of having a magazine and just having it, like, this is a moment. It's not a perfect moment, but it's everything that happened at this one time, and this is it sort of frozen, and this is what we, the magazine that we made. Well, that's probably a nice note to end on. So thank you very much, Neil and Amanda.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.